Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and we're going to be discussing a subject matter that has, oh my goodness, especially the past 3 days, come up in conversations that I've had with so many people. And for those of you listening, our book today that we're discussing is Leaning Into Sharp Points, written by Stan Goldberg. It's about how to be practical if you're a caregiver, but also to be able to nurture caregivers. Stan, I want to welcome you to the show.
Well, thank you, Don. It's a pleasure being here.
Well, you have quite an interesting series of things that have happened with your writing. You have won a number of awards. You put out a book, Lessons for the Living. You won at the London Book Festival. And you really have a passion for this. With you being named the Hospice Volunteer Association's Volunteer of the Year in 2009, that's quite a statement about your commitment in working with individuals that are leaving this experience of life. What was it that drew you into that arena? So many people are so fearful of dealing with the dying. It's as if it's something that is not never supposed to happen, and of course it does. How is it that you decided this was something that you wanted to dedicate your life to?
Well, I think I went into that decision yelling, kicking, and screaming.
Now, wait a minute. Yelling, kicking, and screaming?
I was diagnosed with an aggressive form of prostate cancer about 8 years ago. And my fear of death was no less than most people. It's something we don't think about, something we fear. And I was very fearful of it. And what happened was I spent 3 months really being very isolated, not accepting help, not accepting even any compassion for anyone, because I just didn't want to deal with the possibility that I might be dead soon, which was the diagnosis. And a friend of ours was having a party. She asked my wife and I to come, and we did. And she said, there's someone here that wants to meet you. And it was a gentleman who was in his 80s, and he knew that I was a retired speech-language pathologist, and he had a partner who was in a hospice. In San Francisco, the largest care facility for the indigent is called Laguna Honda, and they have a hospice unit there. So he asked me to come and see his partner, and possibly I can explain to the staff how to communicate with him, because he also had a stroke and was aphasic.
And
I was very reluctant to go, because I had been there. I had supervised some of my students about 10 years prior. And I thought, this is not the place that I want to visit when I don't know how much longer I have to live.
Mm-hmm.
But I did it anyway, and went into the facility, got into the ward. And, you know, I expected it to be the most dismal, horrible thing I would ever encounter. And it was like a living room. And people were, everyone was in bathrobes, but they were conversing. It was like you went into someone's home. And I spent time there, probably about 4 hours, 4 or 5 hours. And I saw people who were going from bed to bed and had regular street clothes. And there was this look on their face, and I thought, you know, I wish I could look like that, or I wish I could feel like they look. And I finally said, who are these people? Because they would go to the side of someone who obviously was getting close to dying, and they would talk to them quietly, and there was no fear on their face, and they just you know, they just, you know, looked wonderful. And so my question of who they were, someone said, they're volunteers. And I thought, well, you know, I don't know what I'm getting into, but if I could feel one half of what these people are expressing, I want to do that. And I signed up to for training, and I became a hospice volunteer, and I've been doing that for 8 years.
It is transformative, isn't it?
Oh, it's absolutely. It's not only, you know, it's transformative, but it's in a way that most people don't realize what happens, because it's not a single event. It's every time that I'm at the bedside of someone in hospice, I leave different. And I think that's why people keep coming back and remain hospice volunteers for many years, because it never stops. You always, I mean, it was a joke with my family when I first started. They didn't know who I would become every time I did my hospice shift, because I just kept learning new things about myself. And it's 8 years, and I still learn every time I sit with someone.
I think that is so significant. I know that I was in a hospice situation here in the Pacific Northwest with a very dear friend. And the most, and the environment was just beautiful. It really was. And that sounds sort of strange, but it really was a beautiful environment. It was attractively decorated. The room was comfortable, warm. And the patient was given, my friend was given as much comfort as she possibly could be. And as you mentioned, people were going in and out. There were members of family there. They were chatting. And the key was to keep things balanced. And I know having a client of mine who was a nurse who dealt with dying on a regular basis, she said she had learned so many things. And when her mother-in-law had to go, and we discussed this at length because her mother-in-law was a very good friend of mine, she said, we have beautiful music playing, we remember the lovely things that she liked, and made it as comfortable as we could for her. And so her passing was very, very peaceful. And I think sometimes when this subject comes up, it just makes the insides of some people begin to shrivel.
Absolutely.
They just get all tight inside. And they sometimes start getting very emotional, and they also will become very frightened. And I have had people say to me, I'm terrified. I'm absolutely terrified of dying. They feel helpless if they are the patient, the person that is in their final days many times. But I find many, many times people who are ready to pass over, they're not anxious at all. It's the people around them that are very anxious, because they really don't know how to respond. Now, your book starts off with basics. What do people do? How can individuals, if they're made aware of a very good friend that is dying and they may want to go visit them? I know people that won't, that absolutely won't go see anyone if they're in the last phases. They just don't want to do that. But if you do, how is it, and what would you recommend to someone? How should they conduct themselves?
Well, you know, there are certain things that seem to happen almost universally near the end of someone's life. And one of the things has to do with a sense of closure. As people get closer to dying, you know, they no longer have a need for any of those defense mechanisms that we've spent a lifetime building. And they drop those. And there's a sense of honesty that you'll find in people who are dying that's unlike anything I've ever experienced, other than maybe a very young child who hasn't learned how to become defensive yet. So when you have, you know, that honesty in a person, that's what you want to, approach them at that level. That you don't have to talk about niceties. You don't have to pretend that something is going on that isn't. They're, you know, they're going to relish every minute they have with you. And oftentimes, to do that, they want to express to you some of the feelings they've had for you and express gratitude for what you've done for them. And in turn, you get an opportunity to tell someone before they die how important of a person they've been. It's an incredible experience. And I think instead of someone going into the situation with almost like a script of do's and don'ts, if you just assume that whatever you're going to hear from the person who is dying is what they feel, mm-hmm. and if you approach them with absolute, total honesty, you know, you're not going to have a problem on what's the right thing or the wrong thing to say, because it'll happen naturally.
I agree with that. You have some fabulous stories in here, and one of the biggest challenges that the survivors face is dealing with the change that their mm-hmm. loved one, their very dear friend, is making their exit in life.
Right.
And sometimes we don't know how to deal with that change. Sometimes people, when they see someone that maybe has been very, very strong and now they're vulnerable, they are physically in very bad shape, what would you say to them? How can they deal with this change?
Well, I think that I'll give you the answer that was given to me by a hospice nurse many years ago. And this was, I just was starting my training. And the first patient I was assigned to was no more than about 4 days away from dying. And I had gotten quite close to him. And I wasn't quite sure how I was going to deal with that, with his death. So I asked the hospice nurse, how do you, you know, deal with the death of a patient? And she said, I've been doing this for 20 years. I probably have helped maybe 4,000 or 5,000 people die. And it's all she did. She just did hospice work. And she said, if I became upset about each person because they died, I would go crazy. She said, but what I do instead, when I leave the bedside of that person, the question I ask myself is, when I left, are they in more comfort than they were before I came? Mm-hmm. And she defined comfort not just physically, but emotionally comforting. So that, for her, was the criteria for, you know, whether she was making a difference. And I think a lot of people, you know, if they can assume that attitude, it's not whether or not you can do anything to help this person live longer. It's, are they more comfortable now after you've left than before you came? And mm-hmm. and just that change of attitude, I think, affects a lot of the grief that people may feel just thinking about the loss of that individual.
That grief is very real. One of the components that I think you address very, very nicely in your book is dealing with the changes in temperament and disposition of that person that mm-hmm. is dying. And I've known a number of situations where that individual is so angry that they are just downright nasty to staff, to family members. They're just absolutely hideous. And I know that I have talked with people who are dealing with this, and they just are at a loss. What would you recommend to someone who is dealing with someone who has been put into a facility, they're coming to the end of their life, and that individual is just furious. That individual is just lashing out, just being as negative. I mean, it's your worst nightmare. What would you recommend? Yeah. How would you recommend someone work with that situation?
I think one of the most important things for caregivers to understand is that the world that they live in is very different than the world of someone who has a chronic or terminal illness. You know, we are our histories. We you know, we are our emotions. We are what we're feeling at that time. And oftentimes that comes down in how we express things. So often when I hear about the anger of a patient, and I hear someone talking about that anger, that expression, you know, they're defining it in terms of what makes that healthy person angry. And what I found quite often is that the various emotions that are expressed by people with chronic and terminal illnesses often are the only things that may be left as a way of communicating. So the anger that's expressed to a staff member might really be the anxiety that person feels about not finishing things, about feeling they may not be forgiven for something they've done in the past. So what, you know, my suggestion when I work with staff is to try to think about what this inappropriate expression really is trying to communicate. And very rarely is anger directly related to the person who receives it. It's usually, you know, you're just collateral damage. You're there mm-hmm. when the person is expressing something. There's a Japanese martial arts called Aikido. And Aikido, what you do is someone comes at you with a lot of energy, and you gently redirect them away. So their anger doesn't approach you, but it's moved in other directions. And I think that what I've seen, so I've had anger, you know, I've been part of the collateral damage when patients got angry. And mm-hmm. the first time it happened, I took it personally. And then I said, well, wait a minute, you know, this is not about me. This individual is dying. They're dealing with incredibly complex issues. I need to withhold my judgment and not react as if this was an angry person. React as if this was a person in pain. And things started changing. You know, it's like if someone, you know, hurls anger at you and you don't reciprocate, oftentimes it's not expressed as strongly the next time. So that it's understanding that the world of the caregiver, the world of the person with illness are very separate.
I like what you say in your book that we should not attach blame. So many times when we are seeing the process of death, and I've known this with many individuals, they'll say, oh, this person hasn't smoked. If they hadn't eaten their 5,000 Twinkies, they'd still be alive. Their life could be this, that, or the other. And the reality is that we're all going to have the experience mm-hmm. at some time, one point or another. And it is, I think, having the attitude that it's okay to release. It's okay. You don't have to blame. Things are what they are. And living in the moment that you have with that individual to the best of your capacity is really the best thing that you can do. Now, you talk about different cultures in your book and the way death is addressed. Let's talk about the Japanese culture and some of the other cultures. And what did you learn in your research when you were looking at these variables that we deal with in the West and how so many times it's so tough in the Western world?
Yeah.
Although I don't think the pioneers had that much of a challenge with it.
No.
But in our modern world, it's almost as if we are detached. We make everything so sanitary.
Mm-hmm.
What did you discover about other cultures?
Well, about 3 or 4 years ago, I went to Japan, and I play a musical instrument made out of bamboo called the shakuhachi. So this was a trip where we were going all through Japan and looking at the history of the instrument and where the bamboo was grown and going to, you know, different teachers. So we got to see an awful lot of Japan. And what one thing that I kept noticing was that you driving through these small towns, and here was a tea shop, and right next to the tea shop was a cemetery, and next to the cemetery was a store selling teenagers' clothes, and then another cemetery, and then a sandwich shop, and it was as if you know, they integrated the death experience within everyday living. So it wasn't shocking to see cemeteries. I compare it here in, I live in San Francisco, and there's an area south of San Francisco called Colma, C-O-L-M-A, and they have more individuals who are dead in Colma than are alive. And what the city fathers did years ago is decided this would be a good place to put all the cemeteries. So it's hidden away. You can't tell it's a cemetery. And that reflects what I've seen in a lot of Western cultures. In the United States, I've also toured in Great Britain and Canada. It's pretty much the same. We take the notion of dying and divorce that from living as if they're two separate things. And in the Middle Ages, when we didn't have cures for most of the illnesses we have now, you know, people would get sick, they knew they were going to die, they laid in bed, called in all of the relatives, gave away the furniture, they died, and life went on. Mm-hmm. And I think what happened as we started getting more modern and more scientific, and we thought we had a cure for almost everything, death then became something to be avoided and not talked about and pushed off to the side. So I think that culturally, most Western societies have taken death and separated from life. Now, even though many of the Eastern cultures don't do that, there are still a lot of things that happen that are just as superstitious, in terms of death, as that we do here in Western society. You know, I've good friends whose family lives in Taiwan, and until about I think 15 years ago, they did not have DNRs, do not resuscitate. And so in spite of someone being close to death, physicians wouldn't be able to allow that person to die normally. They had to do everything possible to save that person's life because it was a cultural thing. So, you know, there isn't one society that I've seen that I've done research on that I could say, yes, this is the ideal way to look at death and dying. You know, I think we all of us have a very long way to go to that point where I think it's going to benefit everybody.
I really liked your statement about how the attitude, and this for a long time happened here, where people would say, I want to be sure that everything goes to the right individual. This is what I want to do. If they knew they were getting ready to pass on. And I think if you're fortunate enough to have that kind of time, sometimes that's not possible. But it is really a good thing. I've encountered more and more people, because we're living so much longer, that they're saying, I really want to be sure that I have things for people. I want to give them to the people I love. And so they're giving things away. They are doing this. And I just find that that is something that a lot of people are very comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to bring up a concept that I thought was very well stated in your book, and that is when someone is very ill, it's nice to have a good environment around them, but if you have all kinds of medical items out, all kinds of stuff that is relating to nothing but sickness, it really creates a very uncomfortable environment. And you made a statement in your book saying remove as many medical items as possible.
Mm-hmm.
What did you learn about that?
Well, most people, when they're getting closer to death, are in a bed for 24 hours a day, or they're in a reclining chair maybe for 24 hours a day, and their whole world is nothing but what they can see and they can hear. So if that world consists of an oxygen generators, trays of medicine, diapers, bed pans, bed sheets, everything related to their illness, that becomes their world. And it's very difficult to find anything positive with all of those things around. Most of my hospice work is done in people's homes. And one of the very first things that I suggest when it's necessary is to rearranging that room that the person is in. So, I mean, there's certain things that have to be kept close by. Someone who is having breathing issues, there's certain kinds of equipment that should be maybe within arm's reach. But most of the things can be put outside of the room or put behind the person so they don't have to see it all day long. And instead of having all of that medical equipment, what I suggest is let's put pictures in the room. Let's put trophies. Let's put things that this individual loved and found meaning in for their entire life. And, you know, the attitude of the person who is ill changes when that occurs. I mean, not only is it more peaceful and restful and meaningful, but also, as difficult as it sounds for a lot of people, it becomes easier to control the pain because a lot of the stress is gone. So it's a very important thing, both physically and psychologically, to make dying, this is going to sound strange to some people, but to make dying as joyful as it possibly can be.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And that is something that I have experienced in different environments, and it really does make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
It really, really does make a difference. And I know the hospice center that we have locally, they do a very fine job with that. They really, really do. The staff is just marvelous. Well, I know that we are just about out of time, Stan, and your book has so many good points inside of it about organizations to contact, what to do when you can no longer take care of a loved one, and just dealing with so many aspects that people, my goodness, more and more of this is happening every day.
Yeah.
And especially with the huge, the millions of baby boomers that are going to be living maybe into their 90s, and their families are going to be taking care of this. And they could easily live over 100. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have this phenomenal shift to such a level that I don't know it's been experienced in a known time frame with the amount of elderly that we're going to be dealing with. And it is so very, very difficult. Some people end up taking care of someone for maybe just 4 months, 6 months. Other times it might be 14, 20 years. I was talking with someone this weekend who had been a caretaker for someone, and they said, I'm tired. And I just think you give so many good tips in your book, Stan, and your compassion is obvious because of what you've done. You're doing well, which I'm very pleased about. I think your book, Leaning Into Sharp Points, Practical Guidance in Nurturing Support for Caregivers, it's more than that. I think it gives a very good perspective for anyone, whether that, believe it or not, if someone wanted to prepare for their own demise and take care of things, see that things are certain in order for their family, so that they would know what their wishes are. I think your book goes a long way to explaining so many different aspects of dealing with the final step of life, which is death itself. Now, what is your website that people can go to?
It's Stan Goldberg, writer, WRITER, .com.
Stan Goldberg, writer, .com.
Right.
And I just think that is wonderful. There's information there. I know for many people it's very difficult to talk about death. However, I feel it's something that's healthy to talk about because it's going to happen. None of us are exempt from it, and it's good when you can have understanding. As a counselor, I've dealt with a lot of variables. I don't know it all. I think it's always good to have the experience and knowledge of people like Stan who have chosen to deal with it as a hospice worker, and now he's written about it. And I think he goes a long way to making understanding about how to deal with situations in life with the death of a loved one is very important. Stan Goldberg, it's been a pleasure having you as a guest. His book, again, is Leaning Into Sharp Points, and we're taking a break. This is Donna Sebo. Check out his book or his website, stangoldbergwriter.com. We're going to be right back.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com. That's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N. And find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007. That's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone lines are now open. Give me a call at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Well, first I want to thank all of the wonderful people at the Women's Show in Seattle, Washington. We just had an incredibly dynamic weekend, and I was just amazed at the amount of people we were able to interact with in my women's forum that I did on Friday. Wow, it was just a fabulous success. And, of course, my speaking engagement on Sunday there was just wonderful, too. So it was just great. We just had an absolutely, absolutely wonderful time. And I want to thank the 6-7 ladies that worked with me. They did just a wonderful job supporting me so that I could do readings for people or be away from the booth speaking, and they manned the ship for me, so I really appreciate their support. It's springtime. Yes, 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 and are you ready for it? Boy, are we ready for it in the Pacific Northwest, and I am seeing flowers in bloom. I am just amazed. Color is beginning to come out. The crocus are up and blooming, usually the first ones out. Rhodies, however, have also started blooming, and here in the Pacific Northwest, they're blooming all year round, not almost all year round, not during the winter, but it is just absolutely incredibly wonderful to see these energetic flower souls just popping up and showing their colorful faces. Vicki Taylor wrote a wonderful little ditty about spring. She said, "Winter's bidding farewell. Spring is in the air, transforming each garden and hillside everywhere." Boy, is that the truth. It is a joy. If you're like me, you're ready for it. Enough of the snow. Enough of the cold. Although we're still getting the cold. Here in the Pacific Northwest, we can even get cold. We can get snowstorms in May. That's happened. Not very often, but it has happened. So give me a buzz if you want to chat, 888-627-6008. If you're a first-time listener, all I need from you is your first name or your initial, and then after that, sit back, relax, let me tell you what I perceive, and then you're welcome to ask me a question about anything you like. Well, have you ever been in a situation where you have had a foot-in-mouth condition? I think just about everybody has had those moments, and we wish we didn't, but how do you handle them? What do you do with it? Well, there's different approaches, And I think that Ann Post and a couple of other people have some interesting suggestions. And sometimes maybe people tell little white lies about something, and by golly, we're caught. Well, sometimes it's just owning up to it, just saying, well, you're correct. I said this, and I shouldn't have said it. And gossiping. What do you do if you find out that you have been overheard and someone confronts you? Well, again, I think honesty in this case is a good policy. And you can say what you need to say and why you said it. Gossiping is often, in my mind's view, something that's pretty negative. We're really bashing somebody. So I think that it doesn't have to be that way. I think if we think before we speak, we save ourselves a lot of problems. Now, what if you've put up something on Facebook? In our world today, if you're looking for a job, do you know that they actually have hired people to find out what kind of an image you have in the social networking environment? A lot of people have been turned away from jobs because of that. And sometimes we don't think it's any big deal, but anytime you put stuff up on the internet, you are out there in the open before everybody and everything. And lots of times you think, oh, nobody's going to see it. Mm-mm, that's not the case. Well, if it is a situation that comes up with you, how in the world, how do you handle this? First of all, don't put your personal life up where everybody can see it. I can remember when I was a little girl, it was always stated to me, don't air your dirty laundry. Well, maybe it's not dirty laundry, but maybe it is some wild and wacky stuff that someone else may not find particularly appropriate. Well, this is what the suggestion was by for some of the professionals. They said, if let's say your boss hears about something and sees something up on Facebook, and he said, apologize. And just say, this was a special celebration, and we got carried away a little bit, but it wasn't meant to be offensive to anyone. But also, don't repeat the mistake. Don't go back and do this again. And you need to take responsibility for who you are, your behavior, and the results of things. That's nothing new. It really is nothing new. Also, what do you do if you send an email to the wrong person? I think, again, apology is what you have to do. Many times, if you're like me, you're so busy, your fingers will fly over a keyboard, and you'll say, I want to send this message. You hit it, and you haven't double-checked who you're sending it to. And that's very easy to do. If you're one of those speed people on the keyboard, and it's boom, 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 ding, 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 you also need to be very thoughtful about what you say. And if you work for a company, you need to not put anything in an email that you would not want repeated or seen by anyone. You really need to be very thoughtful about it. And if you have been in a situation where you've forgotten someone's name, oh, gracious, that's happened to me so many times. I know the person's name as well as I know my own, but for some reason, there is this blank moment. Tell them, for some reason, your name is just not there for me. Please give me your name again. Well, all you have to do is just be attentive. And again, don't hesitate to be honest with people. I really think it is very, very important, and I think it makes a great deal of difference. By golly, there was a situation that I encountered recently where I misunderstood some information, and actually it took a phone call. Emails sometimes are very limited in their communication capacity because someone, when they read something, depending on how it's worded, may have a different picture of information that you're trying to convey in their mind than what you actually are trying to say. So my feeling is, instead of being detached, pick up the telephone and make a phone call. Talk to people directly. I've encountered a number of professional people that say, I am so frustrated when I'm trying to deal with employees or individuals because they want to text me. That's not what I want. I want communication. I want you to talk to me. I want to know how you respond to things. I remember a person that had been hired for sales. It was supposed to take care of business. The boss specifically told them you were to call on this client. They were texting the client. The boss ended up firing this person. They said, we deal in personal relationships here. You are not just to text. You are not conveying enough information. You must pick up the telephone and talk to people. Do you know I'm finding people that actually have a real attitude about talking on the phone? You can't get them to talk on the phone. And when you meet them in person, you find that they have that same kind of detached attitude. And I've known people to sit and text when they're sitting and having a conversation with someone. They're looking down at their instrument and they're just texting away. Please, when you're in the presence of someone, don't text. Talk. Put the cotton picking machine aside and communicate with people. This is important. If you think that the texting and or the emailing is really going to develop relationships with people, it will to a certain level. But not really to the level that is going to have the meaning. One-on-one makes a difference. Communication is necessary. And I think lots of times when it comes to dealing with a lot of businesses, I don't know about you, but I get very weary of this electronic voice that you talk to that you can't communicate with. Have you ever been frustrated over that? Boy, I do. I get frustrated about it. Well, I know we're taking a break in just a minute. I've also got some horoscope for spring for you, so I'll be chatting about that. Then I wanted to share with you some places where if you want to see spring in its fullest, there's some marvelous places around the country, and maybe there is a locale right in your own backyard, which is the case here in for me in the Pacific Northwest, that you may want to check out, because we're coming into this season where so many beautiful, beautiful things are going to be blooming, and we should take advantage and enjoy them. In the interim, we're taking a break. When we come back, I can take your call if you call me at 888-627-6008, or I will also give you information on your horoscope for spring. Donna Sebo here. We'll be back in just a moment.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com, that's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N, and find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959 1007. That's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Okay, let's check out your horoscope. By the way, if you want to give me a buzz, telephone number to call is 888-627-6008. And quick like a bunny, before I forget it, there is an event coming up on the 24th of March. It's a Saturday. It's the Emerald Spiral Expo. It's at the Kent Commons in Kent, Washington. I'm going to be appearing there, and I'll have a bunch of my books there as well. I'll be doing many consultations for people. And if you would like to find out more about it, go to emeraldspiral.com. check it out with them. The program will be starting at 9 in the morning. It's free to the public. Come on out and visit us. We're going to have some marvelous things going on. So just wanted to let you know about that. All right, let's get our spring horoscope. Yes, that's a good thing. Now, this is something I like doing. It's sort of on the light side, but it's fun. So let's take a couple of signs. Let's look at the sign of those born under Aries. Now, what do you think about your love life? Well, I'll tell you what, it's not going to be bad. You're going to have some real close ties with people that are very, very special to you. This could be family, could be friends. And you're going to find that there is a sense of lightness in your life. And if you're looking for that special someone, it's as if you're not trying to make things happen. You're allowing the energies of life to flow in through and about you. And I think that that's marvelous. Now, when it comes to money, save, 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 save. Educate yourself about financial planning. Those of you born under the sign of Aries, educate yourself. Save your money. Don't worry about putting it anywhere. Don't look at investing in real estate. Just save as much cash as you can. Remember, cash talks. And you are going to find that it is going to mean a lot to you because you're going to be able to make choices that you wouldn't be able to make otherwise. Also, if you're looking for work, you're going to find spring is really opening up doors for you. And be persistent. Don't give up just because things aren't coming to you fast enough. Be persistent. You're going to be able to achieve your objectives. You may have to take a few different routes, but you're going to be able to achieve them. Now, what about the sign of Taurus? You are going to find that anyone that's in your life, the bond, the strength of affection and friendship and or love is going to become stronger. And you are really going to be doing well in the working world. You are a down-to-earth person. You are not afraid to tackle challenges, and you are going to be able to see a very stable period in this time in your life. It's very, very good. And by the way, if you're frugal enough, you're going to be able to have that vacation time that you really want. So plan for it because you'll be able to get it. And don't be surprised if you have more than one source of income that is made available to you. But you want to be sure that you do due diligence and always go that extra mile in your work because it is making a difference in how people perceive you. You're down to earth, you're solid, and people like to be around you. So be aware of that and just know that you are going to have a very, very good spring. And actually, the year, for those of you born under the sign of Taurus, should be quite, quite good. And I'll leave those two signs, and that's what we've got. And so during the week, I will be passing some more information along to you about those very special signs, others that we have missed. I also wanted to let you know that we've got an interesting lineup this week. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking with Noturi Thomas, and it's titled, How to Die in Paris. Now, this is a story about a young woman who had some really interesting experiences, and she actually did plan on dying in Paris. But you know what? That didn't happen. Other things did. So we're going to be talking about that. Also, Writers on the Edge, Deanna Robb, is the author of this book along with an associate, and they collected some stories from people that had some very interesting situations in their life that caused them to write the truth about what they had experienced. We're going to be talking about that. And then Dance of the Electric Hummingbird, Patricia Walker, a rock star, influenced her life in a big way. Do you think it could happen to you? Well, you need to listen to Patricia's story. And then The Millionaire's Handbook by Vicki Oliver. We'll be talking about that on Friday. You don't have to be a multimillionaire to feel like a millionaire, believe it or not. You can feel like that $1 million. How many times have we had that saying expressed in our life? Boy, I feel like $1 million. Well, you are a rich person. How can you feel and have the look of that as well? Well, that's what Vicki's going to be sharing with you this Friday, in a week. We'll be talking with her. It's a great lineup, and if you want to know more about the guests coming up on the Donna Sabo Show, all you need to do is go to show information on the BBS website, and you'll be able to get all of the brief write-ups on SAME. Okay, I wanted to share with you, because of our guest today, a story about a wonderful little boy. This little boy, his name was Bopsy, B-O-P-S-Y, and I think that's an adorable name, but when I became aware of the story, it really touched my heart in a very special way. And in as much as we had a guest today that was talking about death and dying, I thought that this story was absolutely priceless. There was a mom. She was in her middle 20s. She had a little boy. His name was Bopsy, and he had leukemia. He was dying. And she had this attitude that she wanted to be as supportive of her son as she possibly could. He was getting the best medical treatment. There comes a point, there's not too much you can do. So one day, her little boy, she asked him, "What would you like to be when you grow up? Have you ever thought about that?" And he said, "You know, Mom, I always wanted to be a fireman when I grew up." She said, "Okay, let's see if we can make your wish come true." Well, after she left the hospital, Bopsy's mom went to the local fire department, and they lived in Arizona. And there was a fireman, we'll call him Bob, and she told him about her six-year-old son, Bopsy, and his wish to become a fireman. She asked him for something unusual. She said, "Do you think he could have a ride on a fire engine before he passes away?" And he said, "Well, I got news for you. We can do even better than that. This is what we're going to do. We'll have your son ready at 7 o'clock on a Wednesday morning. And he said, "This is what we're going to do. We're going to make him an honorary fireman. He's going to be able to come down to the fire station. He'll eat with us, and he'll go with us on all of our fire calls. We're going to have a fire uniform for him. He's going to have a fire hat, not a toy one, and he'll have a yellow slicker. He'll have rubber boots. We're going to take care of him." Well, it was 3 days later that Fireman Bob picked up Bopsy. He personally dressed this little boy in his fire uniform, took him, took him right to the fire truck, and made sure that he was able to be at the back of the fire truck so he could steer the fire truck, of course, with a little help. And on that day, there were three fire calls, and that little boy, Bopsy, was able to go on all of them. He was able to ride in the different fire engines, the paramedics van, and also he rode with the fire chief. And there was a program that found out, a host of a program found out about it, and they did an interview on it. Well, he was just excited. One of his biggest dreams came true. And the interesting thing was is that this little boy lived an additional 3 months. He was having the time of his life. Well, when it was getting close to Bopsy's time, and he was getting very weak, the mother went back to Fireman Bob and asked him, would there be a possibility to send a fireman to the hospital to talk with Bopsy before he passed away? The fire chief said, "We're going to do better than that. We're going to be there in 5 minutes, and when you hear the sirens and see the lights flashing, will you announce over the PA system that it's not a fire, it's just the fire department, and we're going to come to see one of our finest members and ask them to open the window to the room." Well, the whole hospital staff was made aware of this. 5 minutes later, the hook and ladder team with their truck arrived at the hospital. They put its ladder, extended it up to Bopsy's third floor open window. And what happened next was amazing. 16 firefighters climbed up that ladder into that little boy's room. They hugged him. and they told him how much they loved him. The fire chief was there, too. Bopsy said, "Chief, am I really a fireman now?" And he answered the little boy, saying, "Bopsy, you are." And with those words, Bopsy smiled and closed his eyes for the last time. Touches your heart, doesn't it? Good people in this world. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. And you never know when you might make a difference in someone's life. Let your light shine. Talk to you tomorrow. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.